Welcome back to the Hemingway List, episode 222. I'm excited that today when I type in the episode number in the title, I get to just do 222. What a treat. What a rare treat. Something like that only comes around every 111 or so days. And by gum, today is one of them. Now, am I stalling a little bit because I'm still opening my pages? Yeah, I am. So what? Am I also, as we speak, clicking the finishing touches, the submit button, on Project Tolstoy? Yeah, I am. I thought I might have it ready for you to buy tonight, but it's not ready yet. But give me 24 hours. I think in tomorrow's episode, Project Tolstoy will be alive. It'll be a thing, everybody. Pretty excited about that. It is a book, and it has my name. It bears my name on the book, which is a nice little thing. And you know what? I haven't released a book with my name on it for 5 years. So I'm very excited to show you what I've done with my life. Today we're here to talk about Anna Karenina Part 1, Chapter 12. Mother's choice, girl's choice, matchmaker's choice, discuss. What was your favourite line of this chapter? A general discussion about the chapter. Maya said, my favourite passage by far was this. And however much it was instilled into the princess that in our times young people ought to arrange their lives for themselves, she was unable to believe it. Just as she would have been unable to believe that at any time whatever, the most suitable playthings for children 5 years old ought to be loaded pistols. Thermos of Beer said, reading that part got a smile out of me too. It looks like there's a couple of us war and pieces which have made our way over here to Anna Karenina. I'm liking this book so far, and it's a welcome read after the military analysis chapters over at War and Peace. I remember the old military analysis chapters well. The chapters where the war's happening, but there's just so much logistics in a war. And suddenly you're like, you know what? War is confusing and kind of slow. Yeah. Isn't it weird? You've got War and Peace. And I remember, well, during the peace part, we're like, oh, this is juicy. I can't wait for the war part. And then we'd go off to war and everyone would be like, I want to go back to the peace part. I want to go back to society and all the gossip and stuff. This war is not that entertaining. But there are also, as the book goes on, some very, very great, some of the best parts of the book are in the war scenes. So, yeah, I don't know. It's a good book. It does have its slow moments, but it is also 365 chapters long. So, you know, not all those chapters are going to be a blistering pace. Gwenardle said, I wonder if there is more to Vronsky's hesitance to propose than him just being a mama's boy. Even Kitty's mother thinks it is fishy that he awaits approval. She admits she only believes it because she wants so badly for it to be true. This chapter seemed very Austen-esque to me. I like it. Altreat said, Kitty's mum seemed kind of hypocritical, disliking him for his sharp judgments, but also assuming he's got some wild life in the country. She also seems to misinterpret his behaviour. Levin doesn't think that his proposal would be too great an honour to bestow at all. He's struggling with feelings of inadequacy. All in all, she doesn't seem too perceptive, although I will admit he has come off as awkward in society so far. That dude TG said, welcome that dude TG, her mother's feelings about Levin are to be expected, given Tolstoy has spent his last 3 or 4 chapters contrasting Levin's lifestyle and depth of character against the shallow nature of the posh/elite society like Stepan. I think she doesn't like him because she doesn't understand him, awkwardness notwithstanding. I am Norwegian said, mother's choice, girl's choice, matchmaker's choice. I don't know which way is the correct way. Like other people, I was struck by the loaded gun metaphor. Young people are liable to make stupid mistakes which used to have very severe consequences. Very true. And also, you got to remember, these young people are younger than we would think now. Like, we would think, oh, getting married, they must be at least 18. But no, they could be 14 or 15, I'm pretty sure, at this time, and be getting married. So they're way too young, right? I think the mother's choice or the matchmaker's choice is actually a pretty good thing, considering these were kids trying to choose their husband in a time when divorce wasn't really an option. So I remember one girl from the Brothers Karamazov who eloped to France only to die in some lowly house soon after of consumption. That's the risk you take, isn't it, when you choose your own husband. But the most interesting thing to me was that nobody knew what the new norm was or what it ought to be. Tradition had suddenly become obsolete, but instead of being replaced by the progressive norms of the future, you had people stumbling around in the dark trying to figure out what to do. I think we're seeing the same thing happening today with the norms around sex and gender roles generally. If you're holding the door open for someone, are you being polite or are you reinforcing gender normative patriarchal stereotypes? There seems to be a constant flow of news articles and controversies of people who did not know how to act, and without malice managed to make themselves the targets of ridiculous amounts of hate. Jeez, I don't know about that. Sounds awful. I don't think anything like that's ever happened to me. But yeah, scary thought, I suppose. Like, you try to do something nice and people think, hey, do you just reinforce my gender normative patriarchal stereotype? I don't think, does that really happen? If you watch a lot of Japanese movies or read their literature, you'll probably quickly stumble on stories set in the Meiji Restoration era, where the technology and cultural norms of the West were adopted at all levels of society, so that Japan did not fall too far behind. The rest was a lot of conflict, friction, and displacement. There are a few countries that adopted Western culture that had such a different culture before. The Last Samurai isn't a Japanese movie, but it is set in exactly the era that I'm talking about, and the central theme of the movie is this facing off of the old versus the new, of a group of people that find themselves no longer having a place in society. This ended up being a bit of a rant, but it's an interesting dilemma. Yeah, it is interesting when traditions die out, right? It's sad in a way, because traditions, well, I don't know, I suppose they're traditional. It's sad to see a thing change, in a way, sometimes. But then, of course, it's also the way of progress. Things change. Japan had a really nice attitude towards change, I always thought. When I've been there a few times, they have a really strong respect for their traditions, but then they've also definitely embraced Western culture. But it's a kind of compartmentalizing of them. And so it's not like they're not mutually exclusive, and it's not a hybrid. It's sectioned, and they both exist, and they can both coexist, and it's quite nice. It's quite nice. You can get a burger in the glitzy Tokyo neon lights, and then just duck around a little corner and enter a beautiful traditional temple and just enjoy the peace and quiet. It's really quite a thing. I suppose you can probably do that in any city. Al Treat said, I think we're seeing the same thing happening today with the norms around sex. Oh, that's a quote. I think it depends on the intent and attitude. I think holding the door for people is polite. I'm a young woman and I do it for children, men older than me, younger than me, women, strangers, friends. It's just an easy and polite thing to do. I just do it for anyone, really. You hold the door open for people. It's just, oh, I'm at the door. You're coming through it. I'll hold it. All right, isn't it just a thing you do? Am I being patriarchal and gender normative? I would argue no. However, if there was a guy at work who made a big deal about getting up and running over to the door for women only, but did not hold the door open for men, then yeah, I'd think he's maybe well-intentioned, but also holds sexist attitudes. Maybe. But all he's doing there is drawing a distinction, but that women and men, and he's choosing to do it for women. But I don't know if it wouldn't necessarily mean he's sexist, would it? It just means he prefers to hold doors open for women. And also, when you hold a door open for a man, I don't know. I've done that. It's no big deal. But I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. To relate it to the question of bride's choice, mother's choice, matchmaker's choice, what is the attitude behind each? Bride's choice may be the autonomy and intelligence to make a happy and compatible match. Mothers may be concerned to ensure the status of the family and her daughter's comfort protection. Matchmakers, I'm not really familiar with this one, but possibly to please those with higher status by trying to combine both compatibility and prospects and maintain the status quo. What's most important? It probably depends on who you ask. Underlying the mother's and matchmaker's attitudes is the idea that a young woman can't decide for herself and isn't fit to manage her own life. At the same time, young people's brains are not as developed, and status has been a huge piece of the puzzle for a long time, so it's not wrong of the mother or matchmaker to put emphasis on it as something that signifies success and happiness. There are many stories of happy arranged marriages, even today, when people are clamoring for independence more and more. Aside with the person who's going to have to live with the decision, though, so the bride. Of course, a bride could choose to yield to mother or matchmaker, as many still do, but I think the choice is important. Sure, people can make bad decisions that end in bad marriages, but arranged marriages can end the same way, and many people who were never married or who married well died of consumption too. We all live with so many constraints and so many instances where the preferences are moot. It seems silly to me to impose more than there is the option to have someone make a decision for themselves. Yeah. The professional ones probably have quite a lot of connections too. It's probably a matter of knowing who's eligible across different networks and different families and being able to draw little connections there, which could be a pretty valuable thing, really, when you think about it. Like, that was kind of one of the big concerns with marriages back then was which family are they marrying into, and it was almost like a... Well, it was more than romance that was involved. It was kind of futures and lifestyles and inheritances and all this kind of stuff. MMDT said, is this the chapter where he goes over different matchmaking options across UK, France and Russia? It's quite interesting that they perceived the UK to be so free. I never knew it happened so early. And I wonder why he said it just wouldn't work in Russia. Yes, that was this chapter. Pretty interesting, I thought. Vronsky came off as a bit of a mama's boy to me in this chapter, says a thermos of beer, although it was only for a brief conversation about him. Not being introduced to the character yet, I don't know if that's the case. Levin, oh no, it seems both the princess and Kitty know he's come to make a proposal and neither want it. I'm half cringing at the thought of him being rejected, or when he does propose. He doesn't seem to be able to pick up on the cues that Kitty doesn't feel that way about him. I wonder why the prince thinks he's the right match. And I'm not sure about the difference between the French way, the parents decide the fate, and the Russian way of matchmaking. They seem similar to me, unless the Russian way, the bride to be and groom to be, get a say-so in it. Oh, excuse me. I just was overcome by a yawn. Not good podcasting. All right. Let's read the next chapter. It's really short. It's just over 2 pages. So this will be a very quick one. Thing. Oh, yeah. That's what I wanted to tell you guys. Patreon.com/TheHemingwayList. If you want to support the podcast, I will love you forever. That's a guarantee. Patreon.com/TheHemingwayList. For as little as $1, you can show your love to me. And it will be returned to you in cuddles. Imaginary cuddles, but still. They'll keep you warm. This is chapter 13 of Anna Karenina. During the interval between dinner and the beginning of the evening party, Kitty experienced something resembling a young man's feelings before a battle. Her heart was beating violently, and she could not fix her thoughts on anything. She felt that this evening, when those two men were to meet for the first time, would decide her fate, and she kept picturing them to herself, now individually and now together. When she thought of the past, she dwelt in pleasure and tenderness on her former relations with Levin, memories of childhood and of Levin's friendship with her dead brother lent a peculiar poetic charm to her relations with him. His love for her, of which she felt sure, flattered and rejoiced her, and she could think of him with a light heart. With her thought of Vronsky was mingled some uneasiness. Though he was an extremely well-bred and quiet-mannered man, a sense of something false not in him, for he was very simple and kindly, but in herself, whereas in relation to Levin she felt herself quite simple and clear. On the other hand, when she pictured to herself a future with Vronsky, a brilliant vision of happiness rose up before her, while a future with Levin appeared wrapped in mist. On going upstairs to dress for the evening and looking in the glass, she noticed with pleasure that this was one of her best days, and that she was in full possession of all her forces, which would be so much wanted for what lay before her. She was conscious of external calmness and of freedom and grace in her movements. At 7:30, as soon as she had come down into the drawing room, the footman announced Konstantin Dmitrich Levin. The princess was still in her bedroom, nor had the prince yet come down. So it's to be, thought Kitty, and the blood rushed to her heart. Glancing at the mirror, she was horrified at her pallor. She felt sure that he had come so early on purpose to see her alone and to propose to her. And now for the first time the matter presented itself to her in a different and entirely new light. Only now did she realize that this matter, with whom she would be happy, who was the man she loved, did not concern herself alone, but that in a moment she would have to wound a man she cared for, and to wound him cruelly. Why? Because the dear fellow was in love with her. But it could not be helped. It was necessary and had to be done. Oh God, must I tell him so myself, she thought. Must I really tell him that I don't care for him? That would not be true. What then shall I say? Shall I say that I love another? No, that's impossible. I'll go away. Yes, I will. She was already approaching the door when she heard his step. No, it would be dishonest. What have I to fear? I have done nothing wrong. I'll tell the truth, come what may. Besides, it's impossible to feel awkward with him. Here he is, she thought, as she saw his powerful, diffident figure before her and his shining eyes gazing at her. She looked straight into his face, as if entreating him to spare her, and gave him her hand. I don't think I've come at the right time. I'm too early, he said, gazing around the empty drawing room. When he saw that his expectation was fulfilled, and that nothing prevented his speaking to her, his face clouded over. Not at all, said Kitty, and sat down at the table. But all I wanted was to find you alone, he began, still standing and avoiding her face, so as not to lose courage. Mamma will be down in a minute. She was so tired yesterday. She spoke without knowing what she was saying, her eyes fixed on him with a caressing look full of entreaty. He glanced at her. She blushed and was silent. I told you that I did not know how long I should stay, that it depends on you. Her head dropped lower and lower, knowing the answer she would give to what was coming. That it would depend on you, he repeated. I want to say, I came on purpose that, to be my wife, he uttered, hardly knowing what he said, but feeling that the worst was out, he stopped and looked at her. She was breathing heavily and not looking at him. She was filled with rapture. Her soul was overflowing with happiness. She had not at all expected that his declaration of love would make so strong an impression on her, but that lasted only for an instant. She remembered Vronsky, lifted her clear, truthful eyes to Levin's face, and noticing his despair, she replied quickly, "It cannot be. Forgive me." How near to him she had been a minute ago, how important in his life, and how estranged and distant she seemed now. "Nothing else was possible," he said, without looking at her, and bowing, he turned to go. Oof, as the kids say. A little bit of a reject, not in this house, right? Rejection, cool. That was good. All right, I'll leave some discussion prompts. I won't say anything on that at the moment. I'll leave that up to you guys. Head over to the subreddit, thehemingwaylist.com. No, wait, that's not the thing. reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. You know what I mean. The Hemingway List subreddit. I'm sure you know about it by now. Cool. That's it for tonight. Short chapter. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.